From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Benicia.
Sunset District.
I live in Lakeside.
The Western Addition.
Diamond Heights.
Emeryville, California.
Coming up, California fires back at President Trump's executive orders on immigration.
If the new president wants to wage a campaign of fear against innocent families, he can count us out.
Then we'll hear the words of Bay Area writers sharing thoughts about this new political era.
Even though we've been tossed by storm and cracked in the wind, we coming back together, snap.
And local filmmakers take us inside Tunisia's fledgling democracy.
Tunisian people, they deserve democracy and they can live in a democratic atmosphere. I have to give my people this hope.
Fighting for democracy, coming up next on Cross Currents. Stay with us. We'll start today with President Donald Trump's executive orders that could impact the Bay Area and California. Our team in the news department have been looking into it today, and I'm joined by KALW News Director Ben Trefney here in studio. So what's changed, Ben?
Donald Trump signed two executive orders that had to do with undocumented immigration today. First, he followed through with one of his biggest platform points and said, we're going to build a border wall and increase border security. We're talking 1,933 miles long, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. And we measured in California, that's 140.4 miles.
So California is the most populous state in the country with a huge immigrant population. Mm-hmm. So it seems it would have a strong effect here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We looked up the numbers at the Pew Research Center, and California has about 2.4 million undocumented immigrants. Now, I'm not actually sure how they measure that, if they're undocumented, mm-hmm. but they do estimate it's just over 6% of the California population on the whole. So just to break that down, too, undocumented immigrants make up about one out of every 10 California workers, and they largely work in industries including farming, mm-hmm. construction, and in transportation.
So one out of 10, that's a vital part of our current economy. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the reason why many Bay Area cities provide sanctuary, which means they don't cooperate with federal authorities looking to deport undocumented immigrants. But they could lose their funding mm-hmm. based on another one of the president's executive orders, right?
Yes, and this is something Bay Area cities have been preparing for quite a while now. It could affect Bay Area cities, including San Francisco, mm-hmm. Oakland, Alameda, Berkeley, Richmond, and San Jose, according to a list compiled by the San Jose Mercury News.
And how much money are we talking about here?
It's quite a lot. San Jose received $78 million this fiscal year. Oakland got more than that. They got $130 million. Mm-hmm. But San Francisco's tops, it could be up to $1 billion. That's nearly 10% of the city's budget.
And where does that money go? What is it used for?
It's used for a lot of programs like school lunches for low-income kids to seismic retrofitting to cops in the streets. The federal government helps out with a lot of things. And I want to note, too, that the state itself receives a lot of federal dollars. We checked the records, and in 2013, California received almost $55 billion in federal aid.
And yet there's been talk of making California a, quote, sanctuary state, the mm-hmm. whole state. So California's leaders are resisting.
They really are. Today, California's congressional leaders spoke out directly against the federal government. California, as we know, carries a Democratic supermajority as compared with the Republican-controlled federal government. So let's take a listen to Senate President Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon.
We will have no part in their implementation. If the new president wants to wage a campaign of fear against innocent families, he can count us out. We will not spend a single cent nor lift a finger to aid his efforts. In fact, the Senate will expedite the process to pass my measure, Senate Bill 54, to prevent state and local tax dollars and law enforcement resources from being used to help ICE destroy families and damage our economy.
That's Senate President Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon. So, Ben, what's next?
Well, very possibly more immigration policy reform from President Trump. We've actually been following rumors that President Trump may actually suspend visas for people coming from certain countries, mostly Muslim countries, including Sudan and Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
And the state will surely seek means to keep it from happening if it can, considering where they've been.
All right, KLW's Ben Trefney. Yesterday, Governor Jerry Brown gave his State of the State address. He struck a fiery tone in addressing the differences between California's policies on immigration and those being implemented in the United States. We're going to take a minute to hear an excerpt from what Governor Brown said to the state.
I recognize that under the Constitution, federal law is supreme and that Washington determines immigration policy. But as a state, we can and we have played an important role. California has enacted several protective measures for the undocumented, the Trust Act, the driver's licenses, basic employment rights, and non-discriminatory access to higher education. This is what made the Dreamers, and you made it happen. We may be called to defend those laws, and defend them we will. And let me be clear, we will defend everybody, every man, woman, and child who's come here for a better life and has contributed to the well-being of our state.
That's Governor Jerry Brown speaking yesterday in his State of the State address. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. President Trump's first week in office has been marked by many demonstrations of dissent here in the Bay Area. Last week, a literary event brought some artistic perspective on the transition of power. The event was presented by Litquake, called No Shadow Without Light, Writers Respond to Trump. KLW was there to capture some of those responses. Here's an excerpt from Elmaz Abinader's piece, Women Standing in Line at the Grocery Store.
You, women in line at the store, arrive every day. Most of you hold your stories inside while you transform your outside to a new person, taking cues from television. You stuff down the pain of buried children, your destroyed homes and lost languages, while you fill out forms and registration cards, sign leases, and take driving tests. Dear woman standing in line at the store, I want to be attentive to you. Listen well to your whispers, find clues in the way you raise your hand while you talk, or tuck your blouse into your waistband and lower your head. I want to hear the endearments you kneel to pour into the ears of your children, along with the instructions and messages. I don't want to unearth your journey out of greed or curiosity, but as a way to know you and let your story tell me who I might be. I am not courageous enough to put my back to my life, to whom I know, what I do, and how I live. I cannot imagine less in my life or separate from whom I love. I cannot fathom riding the boats that carried you, waving goodbye to my grandmother, paying the man who forged the papers, begging the minister to sign the visa, sneaking onto the train, holding my child, eating food from other people's hands, whispering endless prayers, matching the sound of my footprints. Many of us have not learned how to lose something, but you know, woman standing in line, that acorn squash you hold measures your heartbeat as you move from one world to the next, never betraying the spot where your life tore into. I can see there is a story under your skin, and I take courage from the steadiness of your breathing. I pray that the particles of hopefulness that brought you here will lift into the air, and we can inhale them into our systems, and they ease our journeys and yours too. Thank you.
That was Elmaz Abinader performing an excerpt of her work, Woman Standing in Line at the Grocery Store. Next, we're going to hear from former San Francisco poet laureate Devorah Major reading her poem, Snap.
She reminds me how when we were teens, we were Negroes, and then, snap, we were black and proud. Moving forward, claiming victories every day, on our streets, in our schools, in our souls. We've always been an elastic people, able to snap ourselves time and time again. Kat says she can feel it, smell it in the air, sweet and sour like it was then, only with more love this time, and in a sharper, even more dangerous edge. Then, like now, things were seething. People were hungry and unjustly imprisoned and miseducated and drugged. But then, as civil rights' long pull was bearing fruit, we snapped into a revolutionary force, climbed inside our ancestral core, snap, made our music sing change, snap, made our dances say now, snap, locked arms and spirit, snap, became a dark snap, moving snap, tied a purpose, snap. We sharpen in the rhythms again, bringing out the drums, snap. Tightening up, even though we've been tossed by storm and cracked in the wind, we coming back together, snap. We got to snap. We got to just pull in and believe it and snap this mother back into place. I thank you.
That was Devorah Major reading from her poem, Snap. She performed at last week's LitQuake event, No Shadow Without Light, Writers Respond to Trump. It was recorded by KALW's Holly J. McDeed. What artists do you think we should be paying attention to? Let us know. Leave a message on our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. And now we'll leave the government in the United States and travel across the globe to a very recently formed democracy, Tunisia. Tunisia stands alone among the nations that went through the Arab Spring revolutions in successfully forging and sustaining a democratic government after toppling a dictator. The new documentary, A Revolution in Four Seasons, follows two young Tunisian women, one secular and one Islamist, through the post-revolution era, as they each pursue their passion for a democratic future for their country. The movie was filmed over 4 years and weaves the personal and political journeys of the two women into the fabric of Tunisia's history in the making. KALW's Jen Chien sat down with San Francisco-based filmmakers Jesse Dieter, who wrote and directed the film, and Sarah Mamouri, who co-produced and co-edited, to talk about what it was like to follow these women's stories.
How did you start working on this film together, A Revolution in Four Seasons?
It actually began with Sarah. I was a Fulbright scholar living abroad when the events happened in Tunisia. And Sarah concurrently was in the States, and she met a man named Bassem Bouguerra.
Yeah, there was right after the beginning of the Arab Spring, there was a panel that was held at UC Berkeley where they brought a bunch of people in to talk about what was going on in the Arab world. It was a bunch of different things that started happening in different countries. And this guy, Bassem, had been living in the States for a while. He's Tunisian, and he was thinking of quitting his job at Yahoo to move back to Tunisia to see what he could do to help rebuild after the revolution. And I thought he was pretty interesting, so I passed his info along to Jesse.
You should start making a film about this guy?
We weren't sure.
We weren't sure who was going to do what and what roles were what. But then we ended up, we were planning to meet in Tunisia that summer anyway. And so Sarah, myself, and Bassem all ended up in Tunisia at the same point in time. And then Sarah and I think both, based on that initial interview with him, were really excited by him. And then we became more excited, actually, by his then-girlfriend, Emna. And it was really important for me as an American journalist to also get the perspective of an Islamist woman, because I thought that one of the questions of the revolution here was what to do with the Islamists who'd been disenfranchised all these years under Ben Ali. And that became, that kind of launched the story.
So you kind of happened upon Emna, who is your secular character of the two main women in the film. How did you find Jawhara?
Jawhara was actually through, we literally went to Nahda, the leading Islamist party, and said, who of your of the women you know in any leadership capacity would be interested in letting us
follow them around?
Yeah,
the camera.
Because it's not, because we didn't want to do anything secretive or anything, you know, we wanted to be very, I believe in being very transparent. I think Sarah and I both are, you know, trained as under that brand of journalism, and we wanted someone who'd be open, and Jawhara was the only one of the, we kind of had an auditioning process, and she was the only one of those several women we initially met who invited us back to her home, a fairly traditional home in the south of the country. And so I took my whole family there with three children and during Ramadan. So they let us, they shared, you know, they were very open, and they shared, you know, that very traditional Ramadan wonderful meal with my entire family.
And it was awesome, because when Jesse first met her, she was just the, I think, youth coordinator volunteer. She was super low level, and then it was three months later that she began this process of getting involved with the elections and running for a seat in the Constituent Assembly,
and she won.
Yeah,
so you started following her before you knew kind of where she would be going, that she'd be in the center.
Yeah, we
of
had no idea.
Building this new democracy. Yeah, lucky break.
Yeah.
We had several, we didn't know that that Emna and Jawhara were going to get married concurrently and get pregnant concurrently,
right,
and have baby girls within a couple of weeks of each other.
It's pretty amazing the way that the two women whose political identities are so on opposite ends of the spectrum, how their personal lives just paralleled each other. It's like, did you think about that? Like, this is a gift from God. This film was meant to be. How did you? What were we thinking?
We
along
definitely
the way?
Felt incredibly lucky. It was just serendipitous that this all kind of things just kept falling in line and happening that way.
We talked just a little bit about your two main characters. Let's just hear a little bit from each of them. And we're going to hear from them about midway through the film, maybe a little more than midway through the film, at a point where it looks like Tunisia's fledgling democracy may be crumbling. There's a lot of conflict happening. First, let's hear from Jawhara.
I see it as a mission, as a national duty. I feel it's a burden. Maybe because I am very young. Maybe I am very idealistic. But it's too difficult to be in such a very critical period in the history of your country. Tunisian people and the Arab people and the Muslim people in general, they deserve democracy and they can live in a democratic atmosphere. I have to give my people this hope.
Let's hear a bit from your other main character, Emna, and we'll also hear in this clip her husband, Bassem, who, as you said, was kind of the original impetus for making this film.
Tunisia was not ready for democracy, but there is no country, I think, ready for democracy before a revolution. I can regret a lot of things, but not the revolution.
Bringing down the dictator was, we thought it's the hardest thing, but actually ended up being the easiest thing. The hardest thing is actually to build democracy. The hardest thing is to live up the ideas that we dreamed of when we had dictator.
So it struck me while I was watching the film, I was thinking, of course, about our own democracy here in the United States right now. I feel we're so jaded here sometimes about democracy. We really take it for granted. And this is a question for you both. I imagine you might have different feelings, you being raised in the U.S. and raised in Tunisia, Sarah, that did you find the excitement and passion of your characters for building this democracy from the ground up? Did you find that contagious? Do you feel more optimistic than you used to before you made the film? Jesse?
I would say yes. And it's funny because Emna, Bassem, and Jawhara were able to come to the film's grand opening in New York a couple months ago. And it was the first time they'd seen the film together. And in the Q&A after, Bassem and Emna, they were like, they're in the thick of it. It's still really hard there. And, you know, they were a little bit, they were down, I would say. And I said to Bassem, I said, you know, we were there on those election days, and you guys everybody, to a person that we saw, met, talked to, there was so much excitement and so much enthusiasm. And the amount that Tunisia has actually been able to accomplish from an outsider's perspective is amazing. Like, they have an amazing, they actually did, it was late, but they managed to write an amazingly progressive constitution, especially for the region. They actually have had two, depending how you count them, but successful democratic elections, and with a full change of power, a full transitioning of power. So to me, for all of those reasons, yes, I was very hopeful.
Sarah?
I definitely left the process of making the film with this feeling that it's amazing how much Tunisia was able to accomplish in such a short period of time. Democracy is really complicated, and I think that, am I optimistic about the world in general, about democracy? I think it's a good reminder that democracy is complicated, and we're living that right now, right? Your side's not always going to be in power, and that's for better or for worse. And I think that we need to figure out a way to be comfortable with the repercussions of democracy, unless we find a whole different way of working things, which I just can't imagine. So I think that overall, I would say my outlook is probably pretty optimistic in general for the future.
And what exactly do you mean by the repercussions of democracy?
Well, I mean, different people come into power, and so you might not agree with their philosophies. And so you might, because of the fact, if it's a democratic system, people will get upset about something, and then democracy, the people in power will change. Whether that changes towards something you agree with or not is the big question. You might not be happy with the results.
Did you want to add something, Jesse?
When Emna says toward the end of the process, she says, you know, regardless of how I feel about the outcome of this election, meaning the final election, now, before, nobody cared about what happens in the government, and now everybody cares and everybody knows. I didn't know the names of ministers, and now I know. And I would say that one of the things that I have found really hopeful about our own democratic process is, much like Tunisia, I mean, shoot, you know, I've experienced election losses, you know, of my party, and it was relatively status quo. And I think now for myself and a lot of my peers, we care a lot more, and we're a lot more involved and a lot more inclined, like Sarah was saying, you know, to march and to care and to get our children involved in a way that we certainly weren't, or I wasn't, growing up in the 80s, for example.
That was KALW's Jen Sheehan speaking with San Francisco filmmakers Jesse Dieter and Sarah Mahmoudi, co-producers of the documentary A Revolution in Four Seasons. There are screenings of the film on February 11th and 12th as part of SF Indie Fest. All that information is at KALW.org. Click Crosscurrents. Crosscurrents team includes Lila Day, Nina Gensler Debs, Chris Hoff, Jürgen Klemm, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Jeremy Ju, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, Judy Silber, Carrie Spivak, Stephen Short, and Andrew Stelzer. The show was engineered by James Rowlands. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Lila Blue, who you're hearing now, is only 16 years old. Her first instrument was the ukulele. Now she plays guitar, bass, and piano. You'll find Lila Blue at the Bottom of the Hill Club in San Francisco on Saturday night. She starts about 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
I know that in the morning, vulnerabilities will show. But until then, I can love you and you won't even know. Use my flesh, it's the best.